This is Build and Analyze, a weekly news and discussion show about the world of iPhone, iPad, iOS, mobile web development, coffee, sometimes other things. Really, it's whatever Marco Arment would like to discuss. He's the creator and founder of Instapaper.com. I'm the co-host of this show, Dan Benjamin. Today is January 9th, 2012. This is episode number 59. We would like to thank our two sponsors for making this show possible, Harvest and Rackspace. I'll tell you about them as the show goes on. We also should mention that bandwidth for this episode was provided by VidMeUp.com, a free service that allows you to create your own video site. Your videos, your branding, VidMeUp.com. How are you, Marco Arment?
I'm pretty good, Daniel Benjamin.
How are you doing? What's going on? What's the news? What's happening?
Is anything happening besides CES, which is hilariously irrelevant?
Yeah, you know, a friend of
Please
mine...
Please don't email me.
A buddy of mine was, he's heading out for CES. And he says, oh, are you going to, you know, have any coverage of it or talk about it? Any of your hosts going? And when I was done laughing,
Has he ever listened to any of your shows?
I said, no. Who would go? Why? What would any of us do there?
I can't think of an event less relevant to most of your hosts and the shows that you have than CES. I mean,
and he said, there's new gadgets, Marco. That's what he was saying. There's new gadgets. And I said, you know, I'm not really into gadgets. Maybe the one exception is like cool stuff that Apple comes out with. And once in a while, another manufacturer will come out with it. But there are people who live and breathe, you know, gadgets and like consumer electronics. And this is still a big deal for them.
People besides like the gadget blogs.
Like, I think that's them. Them and the people who work in
those industries. They seem to have a lot of people reading them. So I guess there must be some people.
But there are people out there.
Oh, man. You know, the reason I don't care about CES and the reason I kind of make fun of it sometimes is because, you know, it isn't just about Apple ripoffs being so common there. It isn't even about that. The reason I don't care about CES is that almost nothing is ever announced at CES that anybody cares about 2 weeks later. That's the big thing. It just seems so incredibly irrelevant because so much of what's announced either is a prototype that never comes out, or it just doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things. Like, no one cares about this product. And I just don't know why people care so much about it who aren't hardware manufacturers. Like, it makes sense for them to care about it. But I don't know. People in the chat are asking, from Swilliams, is CES still a decent place for video game stuff? Or is that basically gone too? I don't know. I used to care more about the video game world. And at that time, I think E3 was taking over that role. But I don't even know. When is E3? The spring? I don't know.
Yeah, I think you're right, though. I think that it has kind of taken over for it. And it's a bit, you know, this is the thing. The way technology is today and the industry is today, the big players, Amazon, of course, Apple, Google, those guys, and maybe Microsoft is fitting into this more now that they've sort of announced that they're not going to be at CES anymore. You heard about that, right?
Yeah.
Or at least they will not have a booth there. They will not do a big thing there.
CES was always a great place for Microsoft to announce things they never shipped.
Well, these companies, the point is these companies, they want to control the message. They want to control how it's delivered, and they want to do it on their own time frame. They want to do it in when it's right for them to do it. And I think Apple obviously set the trend for this. Then they said, we're not going to do the Macworld anymore. They companies, the big players, the ones who are capable of being game changers, typically, are not going to have any role in somebody else's conference. Why would they? They'll do their own thing. So the smaller guys, I guess, are the ones who care about this more. Like, you know, I'm Samsung and I make TVs, right? This is where I'm going to announce my new lineup of TVs. And the people who care about that, they're going to show up to see the new TVs, I guess.
TVs are an interesting thing too. I mean, it does seem like CES is largely a TV show. No, different, I mean, you know, you got it. No pun. Yeah. So, the TV industry, and this is kind of an aside that's related to Apple, because everyone keeps telling us that Apple's getting into the TV business. Otherwise, I guess it's more of a talk show topic, but you guys keep talking about funnier things, so I'll cover it. The TV business is interesting because they seem to be under the impression that people have dramatically shortened their TV upgrade cycles permanently. And I don't necessarily know this. There was even an article that said that, you know, pretty much to that effect this week. I forget who it's from. Sorry. But it seems like a lot of people bought TVs in the last 5 years or so, mm-hmm. or 8 years or so, to upgrade to HD and to get flat panels from big old heavy tubes. And
in other words, a new technology had come out. It was time to switch to that new technology.
Right. And it was a combination of factors. It wasn't just that they looked a lot better. It was a combination of TVs had overall gotten cheaper, and there was this huge shift from big glass CRTs that were very heavy and very large and were pretty much pieces of furniture that, you know, you would install in one place and never move, right, if it was of any reasonable size, right, because you couldn't, it went from that to plasmas and LCDs that are very thin and much lighter weight and much cheaper for larger ones that are, and you know, in some cases better picture quality. Although I still think LCDs aren't that great for picture quality, but plasmas at least are really good. And you know, there was this big combination of factors, and on top of all that, HD, which made everything look a lot better. But most people didn't upgrade just to get like the quality thing, like that one feature, that the HD image, you know, that alone wasn't the biggest reason most people upgraded, because most people don't care. In fact, a lot of people, when they get HD TVs, don't even connect an HD source to them. They might not even know this. They might think they're getting HD pictures, and in fact, they connected their cable box through the same old not even composite video wire that they were connected to their old TV with, and they think that's it. It's just bigger. So quality historically is not a good enough reason to get people to upgrade. If you have a TV that works just fine, and you can get a new one that looks better, most people won't make that jump and throw away the old one and get the new one. And there, you know, a kind of similar thing happened with when we switched from VHS to DVD. I think we talked about this before, but just in case, you know, you switch from VHS to DVD, and not only do you get a big improvement in picture quality, but you also get huge improvements in convenience and lots of other advantages. You get like the menus, which I hate, but a lot of people like, all the extra features that people think they'll watch but rarely do. You get the convenience of not having to rewind it, and you know the VCR never eats the disc and makes a big mess and, you know, breaks stuff. Overall, DVDs were a massive improvement over VHS tapes in a lot of ways other than just the quality. But then when Blu-ray came out and HD DVD came out, they were adopted very slowly relatively to DVDs, because all they did was improve the picture quality for the, you know, as far as most people are concerned. All they did was improve picture quality, and on top of that, they became less versatile because they couldn't even be used in your old players and your computer and your car players and everything else. Maybe now that's finally getting around to changing with Blu-ray being cheaper, but for the most part, that was always a big problem, and that's why those were adopted so slowly. Have you ever heard of DVD audio or SACD?
I've heard of DVD audio, but nobody does anything with that.
The reason why most people have never even heard of that, or SACD, Sony's rival format, is that they were similar. They were CD alternatives. It was like the next version of audio CDs, but with much higher audio quality. Unfortunately, hardly anybody cared. You know, there are some audiophiles who really care, but among regular consumers, these things are invisible. They came out almost a decade ago, if not more, and no one noticed, and they've gone nowhere. Although I think, at least SACD, I think officially is still around. Even the PS3 original, the very first version of the PS3 could play SACD discs, and I think they later removed it and nobody noticed. But actually, that's funny. So I might even have an SACD player, and I might not even know it. I have like the second version of the PS3. Anyway, so all this is to say, like, in the TV market, they're introducing these cool new things at CES. You know, 3D has been introduced a lot in the last couple of years. Have you ever seen a 3D movie or seen a 3D TV or anything like that?
Not any of this. You know, I've seen the old school stuff where they, you know, like
the blue and red glasses.
Yeah, but they've had newer stuff where I've seen, like, in a theater, but a long time ago at, like, Disney, and it's not quite the same. So there has to be some kind of special technology in a regular television for it to be able to project 3D in the way that it happens in the theater. Is that right? Is that why they call them 3D TVs?
Honestly, I don't know anything about 3D TVs.
So I'm thinking
I've never even seen one. I don't know.
Can you not?
So is it a 3D movie?
Avatar came out in 3D in the theater, right? I didn't see it there. I've seen parts of it. But my understanding is you go to the theater, they hand you a pair of glasses.
And are they polarized or shutter glasses?
One of those. I don't know.
They're probably polarized.
So you put these things on. Now you're watching the thing in 3D, aliens are jumping out at you, great. You're done with that. And you go home, and a few months later, this movie comes out, and you can go buy I don't know how this works. You go buy the Blu-ray of it or whatever. You sit down, you watch this thing, you put on your 3D glasses at home, and you realize it's not in 3D. Unless you have a 3D TV, and then it is in 3D. Is this how this works? I'm still getting hooked up in the chat room, so I don't know. Are they answering? Is that how this thing works? You need to have a 3D TV. And the 3D TV isn't going to do anything for a movie that's not in 3D, right?
Right. Well, anyway, I mean, all this, this is way beyond even what I know how to talk about. And I won't even give this BS on this show, because it's so far. I've never even seen a 3D TV. I would assume, you know, the challenge with 3D is always, how do you serve each image only to one eye? And a common way to do it is with polarization tricks where, like, if you're wearing polarized glasses, you have, you know how when you're wearing sunglasses and you turn your iPhone screen sideways and it blacks out? That's polarization at work there. Anyway, if you polarize in at 90 degree angles, like one going vertically, one going horizontally on each eye, then you can do tricks with how you project the image in another polarized way to make sure it only shows to one eye or the other. Anyway, doesn't really matter. I don't know how TVs do it. It looks like people in the chat, David Reedy says, the 3D TVs use shutter glasses and movies are polarized. Shutter glasses are weird in that basically the glasses kind of blink for you. Like they black out your vision for you very quickly, alternately, so that each eye is only, or at any given time, only one eye is open and the other's closed effectively. But, you know, I don't think it operates your eyelids for you. I think it's just glasses that anyway, block out the
view. Little clockwork orangey for me.
Yeah. Anyway, the reason I got into this tangent is that these are the kinds of things that TVs are adding these days. And I think largely the population doesn't care that much because it isn't nearly as motivating to upgrade as the combination of flat screens, bigger, cheaper TVs, and HDTV. Mm. It's just like this one like technical feature that might even be a little gimmicky. I don't even know. I haven't seen it, but
yeah.
It's not a huge motivator for most people to go upgrade their perfectly working TVs. To me, CES as a whole concept of almost everything I see there is like a generalized version of that.
Mm.
It's that, oh, great, you know, Samsung figured out a way to have a USB 5 port inside of a 4-inch tablet phone. Like, who cares? I really don't care about like little hardware things like that. It just doesn't matter to me. It will never impact my life. Chances are nobody will be talking about these things in 2 weeks or even 2 days in many cases. it just doesn't matter to me. And I suspect, you know, it's always dangerous to generalize and to guess on people's interests in the general sense, but I suspect that it's not that relevant to most people in our scene or to most consumers for that matter. Hey, you can upvote titles on Showbot now?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool.
So showbot.me is the, I guess, the back channel, if you will, for our IRC chat room back channel. So during the show, people will listen to things that we say, and they will turn them into suggestions by typing in a little command. There's a bot that sits in the chat room. The bot watches for the special commands. If it sees one it recognizes and it's a suggestion for a title or a link or something, then it chucks it into showbot.me, and showbot.me will collect these things. And then now there's upvoting and sorting and other things. But the upvoting is limited, based on the IP. So what that basically means is that you can't, without, you know, some tricks, you can't really scam it. Yeah, you really only get one vote per item.
So I open source Second Crack this week.
I saw that. This is big news. That was one of the things on my list. I do have. I always have a list. It's just whether or not I'm allowed to address it.
Wow. Well, it's your show.
Really?
So Second Crack.
This site is powered by Second Crack, a basic blogging engine I wrote. I'm speaking as you. Its input is simply a directory of markdown text files and a basic transformation. Yes.
Awesome.
Transformation script automatically renders the blog HTML from them as needed. It's unsuitable and unnecessary for nearly everyone, but I like it. And then you have it out on the GitHubs.
That's right.
So that I can fork it and change it, do stuff.
Did you watch my video on how to post?
I didn't see there was a video.
If you go down to the Dropbox section, I think that's where I kind of buried the link. I should probably make it more prominent.
We'll put it in the notes.
There's a video, I think it's in the Dropbox sync section, of what it looks like when I post to my blog and how fast the response time is. I should really link to that more prominently.
I'm loving it. Anyway. Still looking for it. But by the way, I want to, oh, there it is, a video demo. Everybody wants to know, to see the notes and things that we talk about, you go to 5by5.tv/build/analyze/59 for this, episode's links. And, you can go, you can see all of these links. This video will be there. All the other things that we do, will be there. And we want to say thanks to the, helpspot.com, the lovely ladies at helpspot.com who, have made this show possible. Help desk software.
And I should point out, too, there are so many other Dropbox-powered or vaguely Dropbox-powered static blogging engines at this point. Even just like in the last month, I think two new prominent ones have come out in the last month. There's Calapin. I don't know how to pronounce that. It's like Calapin.co, I think.
Oh.
I don't know. Calapin and I think it's called Scriptogram or it's something Gram. Because, you know, I took a screenshot
I'm watching your video now.
Thank you. I took a screenshot of all the different... if you look in the paid apps section in the App Store on the iPhone under the news category, including Instapaper, there's now like four different apps that begin with the letters Insta. and so, similarly, now Gram is being taken for lots of things too. So you're getting lots of different names of products and apps and services that end in Gram. I will take credit for the beginning of the spread of Insta.
Right. However, all you.
I think Instagram took it a lot further, and now they are responsible for the spread of Gram.
Yeah.
so funny the way names these days.
Yeah, it really, I was just thinking about this the other day. How funny is how things change. For the longest time, you know, it was cool to have like .com in the company name or to have like a lowercase first letter or camel casing things, you know, and there are these different trends that happen and naming things that happen. And now it's definitely Graham Cracker.
6 months ago, it was Insta.
Now that's like, oh, that's like weird. Who wants to do that? That's so dated. Insta.
I've had people contact me, I've had people email me, like representatives from like PR firms and stuff, asking about Instagram, thinking that I did that.
Why not?
On some list.
What do you say?
I just delete them at that point. I just don't care. Like any email that gets to me that's ridiculous. I don't have time. Please don't email me. Yeah, so I open source Second Crack. We I kind of launched it on this podcast. I figured this was a good place to talk about it.
Yeah, it's a great place.
And everything I said before, I think still applies and basically summarized by you shouldn't use it. But if you want to use it, there it is. I use it. I like it a lot. A lot of people, especially, you know, geeks like us, a lot of people have written their own CMSs at some point, written their own blogging engines. I've written probably four of them, including Tumblr, maybe five. But yeah, actually, including Tumblr, it's probably closer to five. But at this point, you know, we all know that everyone makes these kind of things exactly for themselves, and chances are their solution won't be good for you. Like, it'll have one thing that, or it'll be missing one thing that you, quote, need or anything. If you look at Second Crack, chances are it doesn't do something you need. Or it's so ridiculously immature in you know, it still has some pretty major bugs that I documented on that page. Or, you know, it's just, it's too immature, too unstable for you to use it.
Right.
Chances are great. Or, you know, in the case of many tools, there's just not enough people using it. And so you don't really want to be the only person using something, because then if things go wrong, you're kind of on your own.
But you have gone on record to say that you will support anybody who uses this by personally customizing the code to their needs. You have gone on the record and said that.
Because that would be a great idea.
Are you not? You know, are you saying something different now that you're not maybe going to do that?
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to do that. I don't think I can offer that level of concierge service.
For $1 a month.
Nah. Okay. Not worth it. So speaking of $1 a month, I have a few follow-ups for Instapaper. But the first one, one thing I was dealing with last night and this morning is I'm redesigning the subscription screen in the app. Right now, mm-hmm. if you're not a subscriber and you tap the search button in the app, or you go to the search section on the iPhone, it'll bring up like basically like the sales screen of the subscription, telling you here's, you know, search requires a subscription, and here's what the subscription is, here's how you buy it, click here. Or tap here, rather, not click. And that the main reason why I'm redesigning it is because there's been so much confusion over what that is and whether it's the same thing as the website subscription, which it is. Because in the app, I called it search subscription, because I didn't think I could get away with just calling it subscription. I thought Apple would reject that. So in the next version, I'm just going to try it. I'm going to try calling it just subscription, maybe in like the list that shows up in the iTunes store on the side of all the apps. I think there I'll call it optional subscription. I think it needs to be redesigned because it was misleading and it doesn't sell very well in the app because it's so misleading. And I'm tired of getting emails about it. So I'm redesigning. I'm also adding more options. You can buy, like, right now you can only buy it 3 months at a time. People keep asking me for longer options. They don't have to keep renewing it. So I'm going to add like maybe 6 months and a year, something like that. And I wanted to know an interesting question I was asking Twitter this morning. Just so I know, when I'm designing this row, so it's just going to be a group table view with the, I forget the name, but the kind of table cell that has the regular bold label on the left and the blue non-bold label on the right, like mm-hmm. in a settings panel.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just putting, you know, like the intervals on the left side and the prices on the right side. And I want to know, what is the widest that a price will be for display? So, like, how long can I make the words on the main text label on the left without hitting the price label on the right and causing something to be cut off by an ellipsis? So, I think, and this is actually a broader problem. Well, the answer to this is, I think the widest is, it's Switzerland. It's abbreviated CHF. And like most of the currencies, like a lot of the currencies that have large numbers because they're like they were devalued a long time ago, like the Vietnamese currency, I think a price of $10 has six digits in it. In the equivalent, it's like, it's, you know, 200,000 something. What I forget what their currency is called. I think it's called dongs. It's kind of unfortunate, something like that. But a lot of the currencies that are like big in number like that, they save in width because they use small symbols. So in that case, it just uses this little like a lowercase d with a cross through it. So that was fine. You know, that wasn't a problem. The biggest problem was CHF because it's spelled out. It doesn't have like a symbol that's used in iOS at least. So it's like capital letters, CHF, space, and then a four-digit price with a decimal point in the middle. So like 10.00. So like if you're making a label that's going to show a price from in-app purchase, so you're calling iTunes and hopefully you're using the localized labels on the prices to display them, you have to account for whatever your highest price is. You know, how big is that label going to have to be to display it in the widest currency? And the label has to be that wide. Or, you know, you could go down the route of having different widths and different layouts for each locale, but that's really, really time consuming. Generally not worth doing, unless you're Microsoft or something. So, anyway, in general, this is a problem for localization. And I've been really embarrassingly bad about localizing so far. I've done almost none of it. But generally speaking, when you localize your app, you're going to run into this problem all the time where some text representation is much wider in one language than you were used to or than you expected. Or like what often happens in German, they have so many compound words that like you have words that are very long that have no spaces in them so they won't break at the same point or anywhere near the same point that you were used to. You have lots of little edge cases like that. So internationalization and localization almost always have weird GUI layout issues that you have to deal with. So just something to think about. I don't really have a point to that story except that it's something interesting to think about. You ever done stuff like that with localized stuff, or are you mostly just doing like sites about wine and cheese?
Never done a cheese one, but yeah, I haven't done that much with the localization stuff. I haven't really had to worry about that. Fortunately, there was a couple projects I did a few years ago. But I don't remember any of it anymore. Blocked it out.
Right.
You want Tumblr to? You want to?
But it was done mostly by other people. I did almost none of it myself. So
smart.
Thank you.
Why would you want to? That's like what you make the new guy comes in. Oh yeah, we're gonna have Bill do the localization stuff. We'll see how he does. See how long he lasts.
It's like. like when you first go into a job and they're like, your first task is to document this.
Right. It'll be a good way for you to get up to speed and learn, really learn the system through 30 to 40 pages per day of documentation writing.
Is that ever actually true? Or is that always like a, you know, we were lazy and didn't do this, so we're making the freshmen do it?
I don't think it's true. Well, it depends. Maybe if you're doing the documentation in the code, if you're doing like code level documentation, maybe. If you're creating a document in Word or something, no.
Yeah. Actually, hold on. Let me write this down.
And jot it down.
Because I want to talk about this too. One of the, I guess, issues, tickets, I don't know, discussion threads on Second Crack on GitHub is... from a guy saying like, hey, there's no PHP doc style comments on any of the functions. And are you going to add some? And I will first preface this by saying I know very little about these official documentation tools because I've almost never used them.
Right.
I think PHP doc is like the old Java doc tool. Do you know if that's roughly correct?
I think that it's intended to be essentially the same thing. I'm actually looking at the page right now to see if I can get a history on it. And they do have an about section. So,
all right, so anyway,
nav things.
I'm pretty sure it's one of those things where like you give a structured syntax comment block above every function and you have like, you give the name and you describe it. Then you have like at param name and you describe each parameter, something like that.
And then it gets processed and it gets turned into a big...
Yeah, you can make like HTML and make documentation out of it and stuff like that. I've never used these tools. And the main reason why is in what I basically how I respond to that person's question, which is that I don't really like doing that if I don't have to. And, you know, I think the code should be as self-documenting as possible. And I recognize that isn't always possible, or you can't always completely do it that way. But like your function names should make sense. Your variable name should make sense. Functions shouldn't be doing anything that's not really incredibly obvious what it's doing, or at least that should be minimized. Things should be properly encapsulated and properly, you know, isolated from parts of the code that don't need to care about them. Things should be orthogonal. Like, you know, all good software design practices largely reduce the need for official structured documentation like that per function. Now, in the case of, like, if you're making a component that exposes an API to an external component, like by a different vendor, by a different person, by a different department in your organization, it makes more sense then to document the public API. But going through your files and documenting each function, even the private ones, especially the ones that are really obvious, and you have the bit, and you have some policy that says you have to use these document blocks on every function. So it's like the function is called, like, you know, open file, and the comment says opens a file, and the first variable is called file name, and the comment says the file name you wish to open.
Right.
Like, you know, there's an extreme there that, you know, it just requires thought. And I want, comments should be done like most things in life. They should be done thoughtfully. You know, you shouldn't just blindly say, well, there's this policy that we always do things this way, and therefore I have to document this really obvious function in the most stupid way possible of documenting it, just because that's what I do, or that's what the policy is. I'm a big fan of questioning authority. And like, it just seems like this is the kind of thing, like, question that. Like, do you really need to document this particular function, or is it really obvious what it is? And if you do need to document it, is there a way that you can maybe rename it or refactor it so that you don't need to document it, or that it needs less documentation? I think that's an easier goal. And of course, you know, these things are complex. You're never going to be documentation free, but you should really minimize the need for it as much as possible. So anytime you have the chance to make something very clear as to what it does, so that it doesn't even need documentation, that's probably the right way to go. Are you a big commenter? I'm really not. I mean, in general, I'm not a big commenter.
Well, I mean, anybody who's written Ruby code knows that there's no need to ever write a comment, because the language is so beautiful and perfect in every way. But
you would never need to read Ruby code. You just sit back and just look in awe.
Right.
At its incredible beauty.
There are no bugs by nature. It's actually, you have to work at writing them. No, I do. I don't do it a lot. And I find that when it comes to writing my own code, which is all I pretty much do these days anymore, that I'm incredibly lax when it comes to documenting and testing. And, I don't do that very much. And I admit it. I do see it as a failing. Like, I always feel a little guilty when I write something. But here's the thing. What's the point of comments? The point of comments is to either for yourself at a later time down the road in the future, or for a colleague that you're working with, or for somebody else who might inherit the code. So I guess they're kind of like a colleague down the road. You're writing comments so that one of those people will be able to understand what it was that you did. And what your argument, and I fully support, is you're saying, if the code is really good and it's fairly evident what you're doing with the code, let it be self-documenting. Don't write tons and tons of... What about just doing a description, though, of what a method is for? A function, as you would say. What if the function is... it might be obvious kind of what it does by the name, and it might be clear what parameters or variables, as you would say, are being passed to it. But what if there's something complicated or weird, or there's an explanation? Do you ever do that? Do you ever put in the explanation of like why you're doing it the certain way you're doing it? Do you ever leave notes for yourself, like to do notes, like I'll clean this up or whatever? Like, do you do that?
Occasionally, yeah. I mean, like, if something is really complex, then I will put in a comment or something. Just, and it's mostly like I'm writing to myself, partially because I've only written code that's viewed by myself for quite a while now, but partially just because that just comes very naturally and it's very quick and easy.
Yeah.
So I will say, like, you know, tag all the links and, you know, comment that, and, you know, then this ridiculous DOM code that tags links, like stuff like that, where it's not really obvious. But if something is like, you know, apply this function to every post, and below it calls a remap function posts, like I don't need to document that.
Right.
You know, it, like the function names, if you can look at the line of code and tell roughly what's going on, and if you can spend like 2 seconds reading the function to get an idea of it, then I don't think a comment is necessary. But yeah, if you have a complex algorithm somewhere, and ideally you shouldn't have that many of those. You know, most pieces of most software are very simple and very obvious. It's just a lot of pieces. And if each piece is very easy to understand, and there's like the one complex one that does this crazy ranking algorithm, then, you know, then fine, separate that out. And yeah, you can comment that. It's just, it's just an issue of thought. Think about, do I really need to be writing this comment or using this massive block of commenting code or not? Like, in the case of Second Crack, there really isn't that much code to it. I intentionally made it not that much code, and importantly, no dependencies on any other external libraries, because I hate that so much. Mm-hmm. Like, it drives me crazy when you can eliminate a dependency by writing your own like 10-line function, and you don't, and instead you require everyone to have this ridiculous library that requires this other installer and this package management system and these 10 other libraries, and it's crazy. Those are Java people. Please don't email me. Anyway.
Hey, let's do our first sponsor for today. It's Harvest. I love Harvest. It's a painless time tracking and info. Oh, people, by the way, people ask sometimes on Twitter, how much of what I say, they're very curious about this. So I feel like we can take a minute to talk about this here in this forum. How much of what I'm reading is what I say, and how much is like it's script? Like, is Harvest paying me to say, I love Harvest? No. Anytime you hear me share an opinion, that's my own opinion. I use Harvest. We use it here. This is how I track time, all the people that work with me. So when I say I love it, I'm like, I use it. I love it. I think it's great. Here's the part they paid me to say. Harvest is a time tracking and invoicing application relied on by the most innovative teams in over 100 countries worldwide, and people like us, HappyCog, Volkswagen, tons of freelance developers, designers, consultants everywhere. Basically, the concept is that you go in and you painlessly track time and keep track of your project budgets. You can send your clients invoices, which I think are beautiful. You can do this with the email, PDF, or right on the web that'll let you take online credit card and check payments and more. And they've got like an iPhone and an Android app so that when you're out on the go and you go to a restaurant, you can take a picture and it'll send your receipt straight into the app. It's very cool. For 30 days, you can go in there and you can try it out for free. There's no obligations. GetHarvest.com/5x5. Get your free 30-day trial, and here's the deal. Code 5x5TV, 5x5TV, at checkout, 50% off for your first month. And it ends, though, that expires January 31st, 2012. So go check these guys out, getharvest.com/5x5.
Why don't you use a different voice when you're giving like an opinion, like, or something? That'd be fun.
Like, maybe I could use my voice if I'm saying, I love Harvest, and then I could do like a really, like a monotone read. Harvest is a, you know, like that, and that way you know.
Yeah,
I'll try it. I'll consider that.
Or like your idiot voice.
Well, that wouldn't, I don't think the sponsors would care for that.
Well, maybe then you could put your opinion in the idiot voice, and then not to say you're an idiot. Oh,
thanks.
But, you know, the sponsors wouldn't want an idiot voice.
No,
as you said, but you know, just so everyone could tell.
Okay. Oh well, I'll work on something. Maybe I could have music play, and like rock and roll music plays when it's my opinion, and classical with the other. We'll figure something out. We'll work on it. It's high on the list.
So in the last episode, I talked about another challenge I had with Instapaper. Sorry, this is like the Instapaper show. I guess, no, it was the Second Crack show, then the CES show. All right. So I talked about a challenge I had about serving images into UI Web View offline. And the way I had done it up until now is by having a local web server listen on a high port and serve images that are, and just, you know, rewrite the URLs to request those images. Anyway, that's why I've been doing it so far. And it turns out that that has problems whenever you're calling to a localhost URL behind a proxy or a VPN. So I'm finally changing this, and I was able to pull out the whole web server. Last week, I discussed a way to do it with local file URLs. And most file URLs don't work, but if you don't give a path, and if you just set the base URL, when you load the request, when the method to load the request has a parameter for the base URL. If you set that to be a file URL of the directory that contains all these images, then local relative URLs will work there. And so I talked about all this, and I said, if anybody else has any... What is that, Skype? What is that sound? You hear that?
No.
I hate the Skype sound effects sound like you're underwater.
They
it's
do.
Like all, it's kind of nautical. And like you would think something that's like all about online voice quality, like the last thing you'd want is to sound like you're underwater, because like bad compression sounds like it's underwater. Anyway.
What are you hearing?
No, just like, I think it's like the sound when somebody comes online or something.
Oh, yeah. I mute all that.
All right, good. I should do that. So in the last episode, I said if anybody has any other ideas or knows any other ways to serve local data instead of the request, or to serve local data into URL or into a UI web view besides the local web server or the file loading, to please let me know. And we talk about it on this show. Turns out there's a really great way to do it also, besides the file URLs. If for some reason you can't do file URLs, like if your data is stored in a database instead of in real files, well, I guess database has a real file somewhere. Sorry. Sorry for degrading your database. There's a class I didn't know about called NSURL Protocol. And this is available on iPhone since 2.0, so it's effectively forever. And you can basically use this class to define your own protocol, or critically, your own handler to a built-in protocol. And then anything using the COCO URL system, anything using NSURL connection, anything using the URL downloading system built into the framework will check that first and give it a callback and say, hey, can you handle this request for every request that's going out? So you can do things like override HTTP and start handling those yourself and serve local, or even decide whether you're going to handle the request based on the URL it is. So you can serve only some URLs, custom data yourself. So even though UI WebView doesn't directly, in that little callback that says load this or not, it doesn't directly give you the ability to modify the request there. Even if you don't use that, you can use NSURL protocol and see all requests coming in there and customize responses there. So it's just basically one level down. And you got to be careful, of course, because then like all requests that your app makes, even backend components, like all requests that your app makes will go through this. But it's pretty powerful. And there's also, related to that, there's NSURL cache. And there's you can make your own cache and customize its behavior however you want. Or you can access the shared cache, which is, you know, just the, I guess, the default system instance of it, and you can access that and ask for things from that or give things to it, and the combination of those two classes lets you do a lot of cool things. Like for instance, now I know, man, all those pages that just save a page for offline use, like offline pages is one of the app titles, and all the apps that just do that. I just realized how easy that is. I thought it was much harder than this. Turns out, if you just implement NSURL cache and, you know, just subclass that and add a little behavior to that, you can make an offline page saver really, really easily. So anyway, these two classes are awesome. They're worth looking into. I suspect that the file URL scheme is probably faster because there's less code in your app involved. So I'm still using the file scheme for most of my images, but there's a few places where I was able to put in NSURL protocol and save myself some data URLs here and there. So the result of all this is that the app's going to be faster. apps are going to, or rather, images are going to work behind VPNs and proxies, and everything will be awesome. I'll have less code to maintain and probably fewer weird bugs that I wasn't aware of as a result, because less code is almost always better.
That's a neat slogan. Less code is almost always.
Yep. So, did you see this thing about Free My Apps?
Yes, I did see this thing about Free My Apps. So this is a company that, I mean, I haven't actually been to the site yet. Maybe I should go there now.
There's not really much to see.
Apparently, you get apps for free, but the apps that are free are not free apps. For example, Cut the Rope, Tiny Wings, Angry Birds, Fruit Ninja. These are not free apps. I know because I've paid for them. And apparently you go to this site and you get these apps for free. But somebody has to pay, right? So what's the story on this? You wrote a little bit about this, didn't you?
I wrote on Twitter. I haven't made a blog post, and I don't know if I will, because I honestly don't even want to link to it. Even discussing it by name here was kind of a weird.
I will not put it into the show notes.
Thank you. Because I don't know if what they're doing kind of rubs me the wrong way. I'm pretty sure it's legal, but I don't know if it's quite happy with Apple's policies. I would guess not. Here's how I think this works. They have a whole bunch of paid apps. They say you can get these apps for free. And there's all these testimonials on the front page that are like, I got so many apps for free that would have cost, I would have spent $10, but now I got these things for free.
Right.
It's like, oh man, how much work are you going to go through to save $10? Like, is that really, I don't know. Anyway, the way this works, I think, so they have all these paid apps, and Instapaper was one of them, which is why I noticed. And they mentioned on Twitter, hey, Instapaper's now been freed. Which at first I thought, well, what is this, like a piracy site or something? They just cracked it and they're advertising it. But no, it turns out, like, I don't think that's it. The way it works is they have all these sponsoring apps that are all free apps. And I guess the free app vendors pay the site for every install that the free app gets. And I think they track this through some kind of provisioning profile scheme. Like, you know, I don't know much about these profiles, but like the special kind of profile that TestFlight uses to allow TestFlight to install apps in your phone, they make you install one of those.
Mm.
And then they give you these apps and everything. I assume it's just to get you, you know, hooked on them or something and see you later use an app purchases. But
somebody is paying for the apps.
I think. So I think the makers of the free apps pay the site per installed copy, some small amount of money.
Hmm.
And then the site presumably keeps some percentage of that, and the rest, they build up a credit for the person who installed it. And then once they have enough credit to buy one of the paid apps, the site buys a gift code for the paid app, not a promo code, a gift code, which is not limited in quantity. They buy a gift code for the paid app and send it to the person. I think that's how this is working. I'd love to hear if anybody else knows otherwise. And so I think that's technically okay by a lot of policies, but I don't know. It sounds like the kind of, so I was trying to think, you know, why would people do this? So, and one of the sponsoring apps was The Daily. So that's, you know, this isn't just like some weird scam app, although the rest of them were all kind of weird looking scam apps when I looked.
Yeah.
But I'm guessing, you know, at first I thought it was a thing to game the top lists. But it turns out people have said that redeem codes and gift codes don't count towards ranking. And I don't know if that's true. I'd love to hear from somebody who knows for sure either way or the other. One way or the other, rather. As far as I know, people said generally that it doesn't impact the ranking. So that's not a reason to do it. With The Daily, it kind of makes sense because you know your conversion rate of how many of the free users will end up being paying subscribers, and so you can kind of put a price on each free user. And So that kind of makes sense if you have like an in-app purchase scheme or an upgrade scheme later. Otherwise, I don't really know. I don't know what this... anyway, I don't know the details, but I complained about it on Twitter and I said, you know, is this allowed? You know, this looks kind of shady. And the guy actually emailed me who runs the site and said, hey, I saw your comment on Twitter. I removed Instapaper. And I'm actually really happy he did. And I emailed him back and I said, you know, okay, thank you. Here's why I wanted it removed. And I figured I'd share it here. I don't know if I want to write this as a blog post because I don't want to draw a whole lot of attention to this site. But the main reasons I didn't like it, I didn't like my app being there especially. One big reason is because this looks like it's not quite okay with Apple. You know, like I'm guessing Apple doesn't look kindly on things like this, even if it is technically allowed, which would surprise me, honestly. It's probably violating the developer agreement for the sponsoring apps, at least. But even if this is allowed, it can't be looked upon favorably because it's some weird attempt to bypass and subvert the App Store and I don't know. Technically, if they're buying gift codes for my app, then technically I am getting paid for each copy that they distribute. So it's not like I'm losing money there. So I can't really complain about that directly. However, there's other factors. So one of the biggest things besides, you know, being on the edge of what Apple allows is not good because if you're in the App Store, you depend on Apple. You know, the last thing you want to do is get on their bad side and either have your developer membership suspended or terminated because you violated the rule by even being in something like this. Or just, you know, like if you get on their bad side, who knows how personal things are inside of the App Store ranking. Like the people who pick the staff picks and everything, you know, you don't want to annoy them. You don't want them to think you're cheating or you know, you're trying to bypass the App Store. I don't know how personal things get in there or if they, you know, if this is like one person who can hold a grudge or if it's like 50 people who won't care. I don't know, but it's really not a good idea to try to subvert the App Store because if you get caught cheating, whatever that means, that could be really bad for your business. It's also just kind of bad form. Like I felt kind of dirty, but like just even knowing my app was on this site, I was really uncomfortable with that. Another thing is that people kept emailing me saying, hey, I saw your app on here. Thanks for putting it up there for free. Like they thought that I willingly put my app there, which was definitely not the case. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that the implied endorsement really, really offends me. Anything that implies that I endorse something that I really didn't, that's deeply offensive to me.
Yeah.
And because, you know, I want my endorsements to carry weight and I want to protect my name and the value that I can give to things. And if I recommend all sorts of crap or scam things like this, or if I participate in all these things, that devalues my name. So I don't want to do that. The last thing I would want is to be associated with this. And then the third big problem, and this I think is the biggest one, that even if you don't care about your name and the value it has, or even if you don't care about angering Apple, although two things you really should care about, but even after all that, what I was most worried about was that this would devalue my app's price. You know, Instapaper it launched in 2008 at $10. In 2009, almost a year later, I dropped the price to $5. That was the last price change it had. Mm. In 2009, that was it. Like, I don't hold sales. You know, I don't do giveaways. I don't do anything like that. My app is a premium priced app, and I hope it's a premium app. That's the whole idea. Like, I position my app as a premium app. I think of it as a premium app. I code it so that I can willingly call it a premium app and not feel like I'm cheating people. Like, you know, I try to make it really good. And the, you know, charging $5, charging $10 for a year, and then since then charging $5 for an app, that commands a level of respect from the audience. And I get questions all the time on Twitter and email saying, hey, is there going to be a sale for upcoming Holiday X? And no, I just don't do sales. If you do sales a lot, what that does is it convinces people that it's not worth paying list price at any point, because at some point they're going to get a discount, and so they might as well wait for the sale to happen. And it also kind of suggests that, like, if my app, if I put it on sale for $1, that I think says to people that my app is not selling well at $5, and that I need this, I need a huge injection of sales volume, and I'm willing to take a massive cut in pay to get that. And that shows a level of I don't know if it's desperation. I don't know. It's not the kind of image I want to project for my app. And I don't need to. It sells at $5. I'm sure I could sell more copies by quantity at $1. But I don't think I would sell five times as many. And even if I did sell five times as many, you know, then I would have more customers and more support and more server load and everything. Like, I'd have to sell like 15 times as many to make it worth it. And I don't think that's going to happen. So anyway, being on this site that gave away paid apps for free through whatever method, being a part of that really is like a big sale that I wasn't willing to participate in, that I was kind of unwillingly shoved into.
Mm.
And that's the problem I have with it, is that I don't want my app to be devalued. My app costs $5. Many people have bought it at $5. I know that all the sales, all the customers that I have who email me and say, hey, I bought your app, they thought it was worth $5. So it's not like I'm trying to pick up whoever I can, you know, at any price, and, you know, just dealing with it. Like, I know this is a group of people who A, are willing to pay $5 for any app, which cuts out quite a lot of people, and B, who chose to pay $5 for this app. So in general, the app users are pretty good people to support. They're, you know, they, I would imagine they require less support than free users. The reviews tend to be mostly, at least, better written and more civil. You know, I'll leave it to you as an exercise to the readers as to why that might be, but that's just the way it is. And, you know, I don't want my app to be viewed as something that people can get for cheap or for free, because it's a premium product. You know, BMW doesn't give away their cars for free. They don't hold sales that where they give away a brand new car for $10,000 for one day a year. Like, it's, they have a premium product. So, you know, that's what I want to be that. You know, in general, in the market, I want to be the premium product. I don't go for volume. And you know what? At some point, competitors are going to come and take this from me. At some point, competitors are going to take the volume. Right now, Instapaper is number one and has been number one for quite a long time, actually for its entire life, in the category that I care about most, which is I want to be the best reading app, or the best read things later app, at least on iOS. Secondarily, I want to sell the most paid apps on iOS. So what matters to me is that paid app sales chart on iPhone and iPad. And I've left huge holes for other people to undermine me. And they are. It's simple as that. I mean, they are. Like, you know, Android now had, like, Read It Later took over Android. Readability is taking over a lot of web browser stuff that I wasn't willing to do, like plugins and everything that I just didn't have time to do. You know, God, I have new competitors every week now. There's like every week there's some new VC-backed company that's written about on GigaOm or TechCrunch that has a couple million dollars to spend to break into this market with some crazy new AI method that they have. I'm leaving huge, huge gaps that people are filling. And at some point, they're going to knock me off this pedestal of being the number one app of this type that's paid on iOS. At least I assume. I'm kind of ready for that. Like, I don't need to be number one. I am number one there. For that particular metric, I'm number one, and I like that a lot. But look at Tweetbot. I think Tweetbot's a good example of this. There's a lot about Tweetbot I don't like, but overall, it's a very good client. So I think it's safe to call Tweetbot a premium Twitter client. The official Twitter app is free, and it's distributed by Twitter. It's promoted by iOS itself like in the settings screen, right, the app is promoted there. You know, the official Twitter app has all the advantages in the world. And by far, it is, of course, the number one Twitter app. But Tweetbot has a spot that they've carved out for themselves as a really good premium Twitter app. Similarly with Twitterific, same thing. Like, they're a really, really good premium Twitter app. They're not number one. Neither of them are number one. Not even close, as far as I know. But they're really good premium apps. Once Instapaper loses its spot as the number one paid app of this type on iOS, and again, I expect this to happen sometime. You know, I'm not going to be here forever because I'm not spending the resources that other companies are spending to do this. Like, I'm keeping it small intentionally because I like running a company this size of one. Right. I like it a lot, actually. And with my lifestyle, and I work at home, I'm about to have my first child. Like, there's no better time to work at home than right now.
Yeah, you can control your own thing.
Right. The last thing I want to do is take VC money and hire 10 people and try to get on set-top boxes. Like, I just don't, that's not the kind of company I want to be in or work for or run. So I'm leaving this room. Assuming somebody comes in and knocks me off this pedestal, it'll hurt for a little while, but as long as I can keep being a premium app, just like Tweetbot and Twitterific are today, they're not number one, but they're good. They're really good. And they're premium, and they have a following enough that presumably it's a following enough that's keeping them in business. That's all I need. I don't need to be number one. All I need is to be kept in business. And I really would be very happy if my product was always looked at as a premium product. That's what I want. And so going back to all this, the idea that I would be part of some giveaway that's, like, you know, heavily discounting for people who are really going out of their way to avoid spending $5 on something, and possibly gaming a system, and that just felt really dirty to me. The last thing I'd want is to be a part of something like that when what I'm going for is this premium app. That's what I want to have. And even long after I lose this spot as number one in this one metric I care about, I still hope that I can look at my product and be really proud of it for being a premium product.
Yeah. Speaking of premium products.
That was a long one.
Second sponsor is Rackspace. These guys are great. They've been sponsoring us for over a year now. And I say they're great because I've used stuff on Rackspace. I love what they do. I like the way they're set up. I've met these people. Mike Franti came out here. Sometimes they're in and out of San Antonio. I don't know why they're not in Austin. So I sat down, I had lunch with them. And I said, you know, where are you guys going? What are you guys focusing on? And this is the thing. These guys have found some of the best companies out there. They've brought them in and they've said, you know what? We think we could do some amazing things. Like, look at Slicehost. These guys brought Slicehost in. They used that technology and they brought it, and now they're turning it around and they've made an amazing new thing out of it. So if you used to, like, look at Slicehost and say, oh, these guys are great, should I go with them? They've basically been assimilated into the Rackspace. And so now you can get that kind of hosting with Rackspace. You know, people think of Rackspace as, like, these huge servers that you have to spend hundreds and hundreds of dollars on every month. Well, they have that. If you want dedicated servers, go to them. They'll set you up. But you can also do tons of stuff with cloud hosting. You can do tons and tons of stuff with their CDN. They have all of these great different features that are available. And you really owe it to yourself to go and check it out, no matter what your level of hosting is. You want a virtual server, you want cloud, you want CDN, you want dedicated boxes. They can do it all. Go to rackspace.com/5x5 and you will find out everything that they have there. So I highly recommend these guys. They're great people. And they bought a shopping mall that had been decommissioned and it was, like, sitting there empty. And they said, we're going to revitalize it. They made their campus in an existing shopping mall. So instead of having, like, an abandoned piece of property out there that nobody knew what the heck to do with, they came in. That's where you go. You go to work in a mall. So go check these guys out. Rackspace.com/5x5. Did you know that?
About blog comments?
I was hoping this. That's on my list too.
Is that a this show thing or a different show thing?
I think it's this show.
All right.
Okay, so let's some who brought this thing back up? Who brought this up? Okay, so the concept is this: some of the biggest blogs out there, some of the biggest websites out there in our industry, Daring Fireball, it comes to mind. There are no comments. I go to this Marco.org site. There are no comments on this. I go over to Asimco.com. Which is, you know, I'm not sure. I don't have the numbers here, okay? So I don't know the kind of traffic that he gets. I'm assuming it's pretty good. Everybody seems to know the site. Is it as much as Marco.org? Maybe it is. I don't know. Probably not as much as Daring Fireball. But the point is this. Thriving comments there. Thriving community of people who go there and comment. And there was a where's the article where they say that John Gruber said he wanted to be right, and Asimco just wants to find the truth. Horace just wants to get the truth. Is that the quote you're thinking of?
No,
I'm gonna find that to you.
Well, John Gruber famously said that he wants to own every pixel on his site.
Right.
I don't know about contrasting those. I didn't see that mentioned. That what you said. But
hold on, I got it. Now. I'm gonna find it.
This was mostly brought up by Matt Gemmel.
Yeah.
And because he recently turned off comments on his site probably a few weeks ago or a few months ago.
Yeah.
But then he blogged about it a few days ago saying, by the way, I turned off comments a while back and I love it and I'm never going back. And here's why you might love it too, basically. Sorry if I'm misquoting that, Matt. But, and it started off a lot of discussion in the tech blogosphere. I love that word.
Oh, and you know what? I'll tell you what. This is why I can't find it on the internet. It's an email. It's somebody sent an email to me. And he's here. May I read this?
Yes, you may.
He says, Marco has an interesting post this week on his blog about why he's... I don't know if the person wants me to share this or not. Person's name is Bob. That's all I'm going to say. Because he did not use our contact form, 5x5.tv/contact. He did not give me permission or not to read it. I will not identify him further than Bob. And Bob sounds like...
But you read his name on the air?
It sounds like a made-up name, doesn't it? Bob. That's actually his name. Marco had an interesting post this week on his blog about why he's happy without comments. Gruber is famed for the Daring Fireball lack of comments. I'm fascinated by this stark contrast with Horace. He's speaking of Horace Dead, UA Simcoe. He wants to learn from comments. The emphasis is not on his opinion, but on getting at a better communal understanding of reality, largely through data and analysis. I was struck by Gruber's comment on the Verge interview, where he said he just wanted to be right. Horace doesn't want to be right. He wants to find the truth. Does right equal truth? It's interesting that they seem to be aiming at very similar goals, yet taking very different paths. And he goes on some more and suggested this as a topic.
Yeah, I mean, I think, my position on comments is probably pretty well known at this point, that I really don't like them. I don't like reading them, I don't like writing them, and I don't like having them on sites. In fact, Instapaper from day one has always removed elements in the page that look like comments or that appear to be comments, and almost nobody has ever complained about that. I got like one request for it once that I have an option to leave comments in the articles.
Mm.
But comments are, I mean, let's address what they are and why you might need them. One of the reasons why comments are kind of the default for a lot of news sites and blogs, especially big corporate ones, is because they increase page views possibly. You know, somebody did some A/B test a while ago and figured out that when people can comment, they get a few more page views on average. And so it was worth it because when you're in the page view business, you take anything you can get to increase page views, no matter what it does to the quality of your site.
Yeah, who cares?
Which is really sad. But, you know, that's... Besides page views, it serves other important roles. One of the biggest roles is validation. You know, the reason why people turn on comments or they leave them on when they start a new site is they think that comments will provide validation, feedback, and discussion. That's it. That's like the three big things, which I don't even know if those are totally distinct or not. Validation, feedback, and discussion. Without comments, your site kind of feels lonely. It's, you know, you post an article and you don't really know, like, okay, how many people even saw this? Like, unless you're watching your stats constantly, you don't really have an indication of, did a lot of people see this? Did they like it? Did they agree with me? Did they disagree with me? Mm-hmm. Are they not going to read my site anymore because they disagree so much? Or was this article so good that it made them subscribe to my site's RSS feed? You know, it's just kind of a vacuum. It's a void. So you don't know what all that stuff is. And, you know, feedback is important too, you know, and discussion. You know, you think, well, most people think if I'm wrong about something, you know, let's talk about it. You know, why am I wrong? Prove it. Or, and, you know, let's figure out if I can update my post and correct things or, you know, post follow-ups or anything else. You know, let's start a discussion. In reality, what happens much more often once you get past a non-trivial amount of audience, first, there's a lot of spam, and there's, you know, there's filtering things that can get rid of comment spam somewhat, but not all of it. There's also just, there's a lot of negativity, because what you have is the lethal combination of a guaranteed audience, but with no accountability whatsoever. You can post under any name you want,
right?
Fake names, you know, no name, random words, and you're posting on someone else's site, and so it's going to be guaranteed an audience. Even if they require approval, so you know, so you make some kind of point, and you're guaranteed an audience. And it doesn't matter if you wrote it poorly. Doesn't matter if you're kind of being like, doesn't, you know, you're guaranteed an audience. And so, because there's no accountability there, like, you don't have to use your real name. It's not costing you anything. You know, there's no risk to you. So look at, like, on YouTube. YouTube has, like, famously bad comments. Like, all the crap people say on YouTube comments, it's horrible. It's like it's racist.
Oh, it's
sexist. It's everything is horrible.
It's like way below the lowest common denominator on the internet. It's like the absolute worst. I don't even understand how. Like, how is that possible? It's like the worst, lowest level of society who's capable of using a computer congregating there. It's right. Worse it's than anything bad I've ever seen in response to a blog post. It's like the worst.
Right. And the reason why that's able to be posted there, and the reason why that happens so much in comments, is because of that lack of accountability, the lack of personal costs to you to being uncivil or just flaming people. With Tumblr, we fought this issue a lot. Tumblr has never had native comments. And originally, we developed reblogging. And what was great about this is that reblogging serves a lot of the same purpose as comments, in the sense that, you know, once you combine it with notifications back to the author, reblogging gives you a way to get feedback and validation and discussion without having that necessarily happen right below your post on your site.
Mm-hmm.
And so with reblogging, it's great because you take the discussion to your site. And in that way, A, it removes the guaranteed audience. You're not guaranteeing that everyone who reads the source article is going to scroll down and see your opinion. And because it's on your site, you're at least a little bit more likely to be more civil and to maybe be a little bit more reserved. And or at least be considerate of what you're writing. And nowadays we have other things too. We have Twitter, which serves a very similar purpose. We have, you know, where you can give feedback on someone's article without posting it on that article directly. You've always had email, as you know, you can send somebody private feedback. And those things tend to work fine. Also now, you know, in 2005, starting your own blog took a bit more effort than it does now. Actually, took a lot more effort than it does now. You know, back then, it, you know, you had to get your own web host and install WordPress or movable type and figure all that stuff out, or you had to pay somebody. Now you can go to Tumblr and have a blog in 3 seconds. And so, and for nothing, for free. And so I feel like, and you know, it isn't just Tumblr now. There's lots of things that can do that too. You know, I don't want to take credit for making blogs free or anything. I guess Blogger was probably always free, and WordPress.com, you could get something, but you couldn't have a domain and stuff like that, or a theme. I don't know. The point is now you can get a blog for free in like, you know, 3 seconds of effort.
Right.
And so starting your own blog has never been easier or cheaper than it is right now. And that's nothing new. That's been true for like the last 4 years or 5 years. So the idea that you need to comment on someone else's blog post right there on their site, I feel like that's no longer needed. It's totally outdated, totally obsolete, because there's no shortage of places you can comment. You can comment on your own site and build up your own audience there. You can even use Twitter or email to tell the original author, or even some of their readers. Well, not in the case of email, but you know, you can broadcast on Twitter saying, "Hey, I responded to this post here. Here's a link." You know, you can raise your own audience. You know, like you build your own audience, and if you're making intelligent commentary on people's stuff, you will get a good audience. That's what link blogs are. Link blogs are commentary on other posts. It, on your own site. That's it. And that works. That's most of Daring Fireball. Daring Fireball is a very successful site. That's most of what it is a link blog. With, you know, with little comments. That's what John Gruber does, is basically make little comments on people's posts, but on his site. And it works really well. He has an audience. You know, so I just feel like there's all these downsides of comments, like the structure of comments encouraging negativity or at least reducing filters. And at the same time, there's all these alternatives to comments that you don't really need comments for anything. They don't seem like they're worth it. Not to mention all the other problems, like just the dysfunction of trying to read comments or trying to use them. Like, how often do you go back and look at follow-ups? You know, most people are kind of drive-by commenters. They leave the comment and they never look back to see if somebody responded to them. And that encourages a lot of kind of careless posting as well. The other problem is most people who read the article don't read the comments. You know, publishers have done studies on this and shown that, I mean, you're lucky if you can get somebody to even scroll down to the bottom and read your article in its entirety. The percentage of people who read comments is very, very low. Also, the percentage of people who write comments is very low and not evenly distributed among your reader base. So the comments don't even necessarily reflect a good sample or an even sample of the readership.
So you feel then that Asimco.com's lock, Horstedt's lock, well, with comments is it a fluke? Is it
right? So let's get back to that for a second. Everything I just said is generalizations. You know, it's true in the general case. For some sites, in some communities, or with some pretenses, they can work. And this is why, like, I think in Horace's case, I think they do work, because Horace's posts are, here's a bunch of data that I analyzed. Here's some, you know, relatively non-controversial inferences we can draw from this data, because all it is data. You can't really argue with it. And if I've made an error or I've missed some kind of critical observation, please tell me in the comments. And so if that's the kind of thing you're doing, you know, it's very analytical, very clear cut, like this is correct, this isn't, this is accurate, this isn't. I feel like that leaves less room for comments to be really bad, really inflammatory or non-civil or anything else. Also, it depends on your audience to some degree. Like, I think if you read a Simco a lot, you probably care a lot about these numbers and the analysis and everything. Like, I think the average YouTube commenter would not read a Simco a lot, you know? So it can depend on your community. The problem is when you're doing what a lot of blogs are doing, possibly what most blogs are doing, that aren't spam, and saying your opinions on things, or saying things that are subjective or even slightly arguable, that's when comments can be really horrible. And that's what most people are doing. So, it, you know, if you have like one or two sites that say comments work for me, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to work for everybody. But also, you know, conversely, if everybody else is saying comments suck and you shouldn't use them, but you have a site where they work, well, you don't, you know, you can keep them. That's fine. You know, you don't have to get rid of your comments if they work for you. But I think the default should be comments off. And, you know, the default of platforms, the default of people, of what people think of as what does it mean to be a blog? You know, there's all these discussions around this too. People saying like, oh, if you don't allow comments, you're, it's like censorship. You're not allowing people to respond. Well, I don't owe you anything. I don't owe you a place on my site. Like, that's not censorship. It's like, that's like saying not allowing people to vandalize your house and spray paint a message on the front of your house saying I'm a, that's censorship to not allow that. You know, like, no, it's my house.
I can, well, you know, I mean, the argument though that, oh, you're not being very social. You're not open. There's such a one-way communication. The internet's all about two-way communication. It's about social. I mean, don't you want your own website to be a social network?
No.
It's but the that's internet. The mentality.
It's the internet. The internet is the social network. That's it. Like, the internet is what connects all these things.
If but you, there are a lot of people, Marco. Like, there are a lot of people, though, and I agree with you. But I'm just saying, here's what I hear. There are a lot of people who, or they're not Marco. I don't have my own big blog, and if I post my own argument if I post my argument on my site, nobody will find it. I have to post it in the comments because nobody is going to come to my site. No, I only have 30 followers on Twitter. I have no followers on Facebook. None of my friends know what Google Plus even is. So if I post my comment on, you know, Mr. Bob's mysteryblog.tumblr.com, nobody will find it. And if you don't have comments, then I can't respond to you. I have no forum. You've taken away my forum. You've taken away my ability to communicate with you in a public forum. How dare you take that away from me? What people say.
I think it's important to point out, like, there's always ways to reach the author for feedback. You know, there's Twitter, there's email, and I don't know, do people use Google Plus? There's always ways to reach the author. What these people are complaining about usually is there's no way for your audience, your big audience, to see my comment on what you wrote. And that's fine. That's true, generally speaking. You know, if you respond to something that John Gruber said on Daring Fireball, chances are most Daring Fireball readers aren't going to see it. But I don't think necessarily that's bad. I think it's very clear cut that John Gruber doesn't owe it to you to tell his audience about every possible response that he gets to his stuff. You know, you don't deserve that inherently. You can earn that by making a really good response. You know, if you disagree with something I wrote, email me or reply on Twitter to me or post about it on a blog somewhere and email me the link and say, hey, I responded to this. And every single, if anybody does that, I go and read it.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's really well written and I link to it. You know, that's, like, you didn't have comments on books. Like, imagine, like, reading Moby Dick. And you get to, like, you know, page 17. And at the bottom of page 17 is a horizontal rule. And below it, some lines that everybody can write on when they borrow the book from the library. And the first one says first. And the second one has some kind of homophobic slur on it. And the third one's like, this book sucks. It's too long. You know, like, comments are not some kind of inherently, they're not some kind of basic right on the internet or anywhere. Or rather, not necessarily, an audience is not a basic right everywhere. You know, you have to earn your audience. And people who have well-read blogs have spent years building up that audience by what they write. And, you know, they don't owe it to you. If what you have to say needs to be heard by that person, email them. Send it to them.
Yeah.
If what you have to say needs to be seen by people, put it out there on a blog. Go make one in 3 seconds. And if it's good, people will find it. The internet is really a very good meritocracy. People are desperate for good content to read, to link to, because there's a lot of content out there. Most of it's complete garbage. So if you're writing good stuff, believe me, people find it. It might take a few months or a year, but people do find it. And you don't need, like, no one owes you their audience to get you started on that. And if what you say is a bunch of crap or it's poorly written, you know, then you won't earn that. But if you're writing good stuff, it'll happen. And, you know, that's...
I guess that's the big fear that everybody has is like, the will it ever happen? But it does, right?
It does. And you know what? If what you're saying, like, if the person really is truly wrong about something, or your comment's really important and really shows how horrible their opinion is, well, people are going to stop reading them if their opinion is that bad. Not all people, of course. I mean, people read Forbes, but, you know, God, that site's so bad. But, you know, you can't do anything about, or rather, you know, you're never going to kill somebody's audience by pointing out some flaw in their reasoning. You're never going to make everyone stop reading them. You know, and you don't have to be right. And more importantly, you're not going to be given the chance to be right. But you can start your own blog and start your own audience there. And that's it's by far the right way to handle this, I think.
Yeah.
I don't really know how to wrap this up, but.
Well, you know, I mean, it's an interesting topic. It's something I actually hope we will get feedback on it. And because it's something that I think personally is pretty interesting. I have had, I used to have a blog. I mean, it's still out there, but I don't think anyone still goes to hivelogic.com anymore.
Do you still update it?
Not very much. Mainly the people that go to it are people who come in there and they say, oh, that tutorial you wrote 4 years ago about installing whatever, you know, from the command line, like that's not up to date. And I apologize. And for a long time, there were comments and there was a thriving comment community, especially around the posts where, you know, I would give tutorials or instructions for people to follow to install something or try something or write some code. And, you know, and unless you as an author are really on top of the comments, not just moderating them, but interacting with the people who are sharing the comments and asking questions, and then you look like a jerk, you know, because, oh, well, you leave these comments and you never respond to your own comments. What a jerk, you know. And that was something that also I feel is a, and, you know, that's something like I was just messing around with this Path app. You tried this thing, Path?
I've seen it, but I haven't used it.
It's a wonderfully designed app, and I'm using this thing, and I noticed that, you know, most of the feedback, like the built-in little things, you can like add a smiley or like a winking smile or like a surprised reaction. I think there's one frown that you can put on somebody else's like post or picture or place that they went or something. Most of them are positive. And that's one of the things that I see a lot of the time, like with Tumblr and with other sites, is that people typically like, they will respond positively. You know, there's a way to say, Dan liked this.
Right.
You know, this is Dan's favorite. But there's not like a
and
button.
It's very deliberate that there's no Dan hated this.
Right. Button. Right. And that's the thing. It's like it's the modern social network is all about like loving what other people do immensely. Right. As like opposed to not liking something.
Right. There's a notification when somebody starts following you.
Right.
There isn't one when they unfollow you.
Right. So it's, you know, I just think it's the changing surface of this landscape of, you know, blogs and sharing things and one versus two-way communication. It's two-way communication, but only if you like it. Only if it's good.
I mean, it isn't, I don't think it's that simple. I just think, just in general, I think comments solve a problem that a lot of people don't have anymore in a way that encourages a lot of bad behavior. And we have much better solutions to these problems now that have far fewer downsides.
Yeah.
And comments are just this relic of the past, like
relic of a bygone era.
You know, we don't use floppy disks anymore because we can solve all the problems that floppy disks solved. We can solve them better today with other means. You know, similar to that, you know, I just, comments are floppy disks. Josh, you know, there's no need for them today. They have far too many costs, and we have much better solutions for the problems that comments solve.
See, now that's how you wrap up a show.
That's it. I'm done.
You're done. You're out. You just sort that's of back it. At, put, throw your hands up, back
stop
out of the room.
On my head.
That's it. Can't do any better than that.
Done.
You're out. All right, well, we will end. So thanks, everybody, for tuning in. And if you want to share your comments with us, 5by5.tv/contact is the way to do it. Marco Arment on Twitter, Dan Benjamin on Twitter. And that's it. Have a good week.
You too.